Okay, hi again. This is Bob Brundage, and this afternoon we're in York, Pennsylvania. We're attending the Contra Dance weekend with Don Armstrong, Dick Ledger, and Bill Johnston, who've been doing this here at the Yorktown Hotel for quite a few years. It's all Contras and quadrilles and some Scottish dancing and so forth. The date today is November the 28th, 1997. And after all these interviews that I've done, I've finally got around to interviewing one of the Hall of Fame people called Al Brundage. And, Al, we've got a lot of things that we can put on tape. And my thought was to start way, way back. First of all, you know, I was born in Danbury, Connecticut, and but I don't think you were...
No, I was born in Hartford, Bob.
Hartford.
I think I was like 2 years old when we moved to Danbury, and then you were born shortly after that, as I recall. Well, I don't really recall, but that's what they that's what our parents told us.
Yeah, so, and of course, we were brought up on a poultry and market garden farm. It was a two-part farm, really. Our grandfather was a market garden grower, and our dad was a poultryman with a hatchery operation producing baby chicks of Rhode Island Reds and Plymouth Rocks and so forth. And so back when we were kids, we're talking back in the early 1930s, it was our mother who proposed that we start a 4-H club and take music as a project. And just as an aside, we were the first club in the United States to ever select music as a project in the 4-H club system. So some of us started taking lessons, and we gradually got a few people together. So do you remember some of them?
Well, yeah, I do, Bob. And just to go back a little bit on that, as I recall, Mom had a real hard time to get permission to run a 4-H club that was a theme was basically music.
Right.
Since then, that club, since it got started and got going, it turned into a lot of clubs with it that suited the 4-H program. But we were the first music club in the country. And even before she got it started, I think the reason she started was that even before that, when we were 11 or 12 years old, somewhere along in there, we used to sneak out of the house on Saturday nights and go down to about a mile down the road to what I think was an old stagecoach stop. And they'd run a square dance down there about once, twice a month or something. And we'd stand outside and look in and peek in the windows and things like that. And when she found out about the fact that we were doing that and we were so interested in that, she decided that she better get some activity for us or going, or we'd be hitting the roads going out. So she got this 4-H club started. And it turned out to be the best thing in our lives for a long, long time.
I guess.
Yep.
So do you remember some of the guys that were in there?
Well, yeah, I think the first there was you and I, and then it was Guido. Actually, now that I look back, his name was Ruggiero, but we called him Ruggiero.
Right.
It was Guido and George Ruggiero, and they had a brother named Louie, and I guess probably he was in it.
No, he wasn't in it.
But there was...
The Schroeders.
The Schroeders, Donald Schroeder and
Ralph.
And there was
Joe Tomanio.
Was Howie Miller in that?
Not right off the beat. Right.
But Billy Waterbury was in that.
Was he?
Yeah. I think. And he was our next door neighbor at a dairy farm down the road toward Danbury. I have a picture back in my office that... shows the people and with a 4-H club banner in front of a table or something, and we'd won some award. But that was not the original club. It was after we'd been formed a while.
Yeah. Well, I recall seeing a picture in the Fairfield County Extension newsletter, the monthly newsletter, which was dated 1933, that showed our band at our clubhouse up in Papa.
You're talking about Papa Hex? Well, that was... That was a kind of a project. We had this band going, and we weren't running any square dances right off the bat. We were practicing, and we had a kind of a funny instrumentation. our mother played the piano, and Bob played drums, and I played trumpet. But we had, I think, at least two banjos and a couple of guitars, I don't know.
Right.
And it was, but we did play music. And one of the guys named Luke Flanagan was, he might have been in early in the club, too.
He could have been.
But he was living about a mile and a half or so away from us on another farm. And his grandfather or uncle, I'm not sure which, was said that he had an empty chicken coop out there that wasn't being used, and if we'd clean it up, he'd let us use it to run a square dance in it. So
right.
That was a project. We went up there and worked a day or two, and all the boys, and cleaned that thing up, and we cleaned his chicken coop for him. That might have been his original idea, I don't know. But we did get it clean, and we did run a square dance up there.
Yeah.
And the very first, it was a community project. All the neighbors and people around were invited to come, and we packed the house, didn't we, Bob?
I tell you.
That chicken coop held a good two squares.
No, I think it was.
Yeah, yeah, I guess it was.
Yeah. But also, well, we had to use a flame blowtorch.
Yeah,
thing
we used a thing called a fire gun. And
fire.
We used to use them in the poultry houses to kill lice and to get a really clean thing that would scorch the the woodwork, but it wouldn't burn it for some reason.
Yeah. It was worked that way. So, but that was, when we first started with that, some of the older boys were doing the calling, though, if I remember.
That's right. I think Guido Ruggiero was the first caller, as I recall.
Yeah.
And he learned from down the road at this old stagecoach stop where they were running dances down in kind of a basement room, and there was an old caller there named Andy Golder. And Andy would call the old-time stuff, and they didn't have... They had, I think it was a concertina and a fiddle player.
That was Jack Craddock.
Jack Craddock, yeah.
Right.
And they would make what we thought was beautiful music. It was really... And we still... I still like that kind of music today, the stuff they played. But you could learn the square dances by standing outside and listening and watching. Because they were all basically singing calls, a very easy... visiting couple dances that you could call for what we now refer to as patter calls.
Right.
But yeah, Guido was the first caller. But
then I've always said to everybody, when did you start calling? And I said, well, we started calling about the time that Guido got found out about girls.
Yeah. Yeah. He, I don't know whether he left for some reason to go to school or what, or whether he found out about girls, but evidently he quit calling. And I've said before that I guess the reason I was the caller is because of the trumpet I played was about the least desirable instrument for a square dance band compared to the other instruments, so they figured they wouldn't miss me very much in the band, so I better be the caller.
Yeah.
And the first call I ever did, I jumped up, upon the bench with a megaphone and belted it out. Two head gents cross over and by your opposite stand.
There you go. Life on the ocean wave.
Life on the ocean wave.
Right. So, and then as time went along, we started getting invitations to call to play for the different Granges and Farm Bureau organizations.
That's right.
Extension service things, all agricultural minded, but... And we started branching out. I wonder when we first started getting paid.
Well, I don't remember for sure when we started getting paid, but as I recall, they started to... We'd play for the firehouse and the Grange halls, and they did pay us a little money, but at first all the money went into the club treasury.
Right.
Because we didn't feel that we should make any money, but the club needed money.
Yeah.
And eventually that... branched out, we had, well, two or three things happened. First of all, with the money that we made, and it was fairly good money in those days. I think we got maybe $15 for a dance.
Mm-hmm.
That was everybody, the caller, the orchestra, and everybody else.
Right.
Or maybe 10, I don't know, but it would all put away, and after about 6 months of it, you'd had a couple of $100 saved up.
Right.
But anyway, we were able to send some of the boys to our state 4-H club conference up at Stores, which is now University of Connecticut,
right.
And that was with expenses paid, and for some of those boys, it was the first time they'd really ever been off the farm or been away from home.
Right.
Or they're going into town or something.
Yeah.
And eventually we became popular. People heard of us, of course, and we branched out. We formed other branches of the club. And we had a firefighting unit.
Right.
Even had our own fire engine there for a while. Bought some old car, put a big tank on it, made a fire.
Yeah.
And we'd go out and burn brush and thin out trees in people's woodlands. And I don't know, we did a lot of things like that.
Yeah.
And when the money got a little bit better, I think that Mom decided that the boys in the band should be paid a fee, and then what was left over would go to the club.
Right.
Because we were doing all the work, and a lot of these other fellows were not doing too much, and
right.
they were benefiting. So
yeah.
I think Mom got $2, and I got $2. You probably got $1. All the members of the band got $1.
Yeah.
And the caller got $2, and the leader got $2. And
right.
we put it all together. I think we charged $10 or $12 for the whole evening.
Right.
And we ran a square dance.
Yeah. Let's see, some of the firehouses, we worked in Beaverbrook and Easton, and we started getting out of town. Well, one of the things I wanted to mention, too, I think sure you'll remember, while all this was going on, Mother and Dad were trying to further our education and would take us to dances out of the area,
mm-hmm.
where
That's
we started
right.
to learn other dances.
That's right.
I remember learning Sioux City Sioux, which is a brand new theory, of course, in those days, and if memory serves me right, we found areas where some people were doing a do-si-do left shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
We found an area where an Allaman left was you hook left elbows and go around about 14 times.
Yeah.
And we discovered that the whole world of square dancing was not confined to King Street in Connecticut.
That's right.
Yeah. I thought that was an interesting aspect that we should talk about. One of the things that sticks out in my mind, too, and this is your interview, and I'm doing all
That's okay. You're doing great, Bob.
Well, I've already been interviewed.
Okay, you know, yeah. That's...
One of the things that sticks out in my mind is the trip that we made to Eastern States Exposition. You remember that?
I do. And that was a big event. That was in Springfield, Massachusetts, and it was kind of a long trip.
We were to lay the cornerstone of the Connecticut building.
The Connecticut building.
Yeah.
And... it's the first time that we ran across contra dancing up there, Sammy Spring, and old contra callers. And he had a voice like a nanny goat almost. He,
yeah.
Yeah, and he'd sing out.
Well, the thing that I remember about that was the fact that it was to be the cornerstone laying was out of doors, and there was no way to get a piano.
Oh, that's right.
And so we hauled a
We took our own piano
of the house. We found an old upright piano, I guess maybe the one that was in the 4-H clubhouse, put it on Dad's truck and hauled it all the way to West Springfield.
Yeah.
And did the dance and the dedication, put it on the truck and drove it back home again.
That's right.
A good 3-hour drive it was.
That's right. Yeah. And that doesn't do a piano much good, but I don't think it was a great piano to begin with. But I think we moved that piano several times along in there to go to dances so Mom could play. Cause,
well, she was the background.
She was the backbone of the whole unit. And she'd do all the booking. People would phone up and she'd answer the phone and she'd book a dance job here and there. But gradually the 4-H Club began to become well known.
Yeah.
And we were, well, and they were called the King Street. It was a King Street District 4-H Club, and the band that we formed was called the Pioneers, King Street Pioneers.
Yeah.
And King Street, it wasn't just a street. King Street itself is a whole section
right.
on like the northwest side of Danbury, Connecticut, and
right.
it constitutes probably maybe 20 miles of roads in a big cross, a big
right.
T-shape.
Yeah.
And north, south, east, and west parts of King Street.
Right.
And pretty much in the center was King Street Christian Church.
Yeah.
But they didn't have any place to call to use a dance at that.
And don't forget the King Street School. Like
well,
you and I attended.
We attended the school. We used to go up, and as I recall, there have been occasions where our mother got permission to use the school for dancing, but it's full of seats and chairs. And as I recall, there's 29 desks and 29 chairs in that one-room schoolhouse.
Bolted to the floor.
Bolted to the floor, and we'd go up there and a Saturday and unbolt them. The club, that was a plot. The whole club would go up there and take all the chairs and out and stash them and store them in the girls' entry. Yeah. In those days, we had a girls' side and a boys' side at these country schools. And we'd go in there and we'd run a dance. And here again, I don't know, held three or four squares, I guess.
Yeah.
And we'd, the band would play over in the corner. There's a big stove in the other corner.
Coal stove.
And then Sunday, we'd go up and put all the chairs and Monday back and the seats and whatnot. And Monday, they'd run school again.
Yeah.
And that lasted a while. And we became quite famous people. That was a landmark. And people came from quite a few miles around to go to those dances.
Right. So, let's see, how do we tie into Danbury Fair?
That's well, one thing I can't remember exactly how that started, but one day, as your fame and that thing spread, different people began to hear about us, of course, around our county and around the eastern side of the state. And then when we went away to festivals and things like that, we'd bring the band, and like the dedication Bob was speaking about up in Springfield, as your fame and that thing spread, different people began to hear about us, of course, around our county and around the eastern side of the state. And then when we went away to festivals and things like that, we'd bring the band. And like the dedication Bob was speaking about up in Springfield, a lot of people danced to us, a lot of people attended, and we became known and the name remembered. And Danbury Fair was one of the biggest fairs in the state of Connecticut, and it wasn't as big as the Springfield Exposition, which was a big fair, but it was taken over by a man named John Leahy, and John was pretty kind of a country boy. He was did very well financially from the starting in his garage, and was a self-made man, and he got a big interest in the fairgrounds, which was then owned by the Danbury Agricultural Society or something like that, and they would run harness races there and have exhibitions of fruit and vegetables and poultry and animals of all kinds, and it became a fair. And when John took over, he wanted to pep it up a little bit, so he had a huge big tent, and our family used to exhibit in that big tent. We raised grandfather on the vegetable side of the farm, but raise pumpkins and squash and things you'd exhibit, and also ornamental gourds and ornamental corn.
Right.
And that was a family project. We'd go down and set up a theme, an exhibition there, and show the corn and the gourds. And then we had a table where we'd sold corn and gourds. And this fair was like in October, fall of the year, when people bought Indian corn, red and various colors, and gourds of various colors. And we'd shellac them and clean them all up and down there and sell them for about a dime a piece in those days. But that was a money-making cash product at the time. And they had a stage there in that big top where they used to have demonstrations. Somebody would cook, go ahead, a cooking demonstration. Somebody else would show an animal or something like that. And John decided that it would be good to have some dancing up there. So fortunately, we were the ones that got chosen for that, and it became...
Originally, you had the band.
Yeah, we had the band there, and we had the orchestra there, and we had a demonstration every day of the fair. I think it ran 7 days, then about 7 or 8 days, and we had a demonstration team there. We danced about, an hour and a half up there, and we had different groups come in from here and there, and about this time, square dancing... was beginning to become popular around the state, grow a little bit, and there were dance clubs being formed a little bit in groups, so that we had people come in from here and there, and a few other callers would come in also to help out.
Which brings up, how did Western style square dancing, if you remember, come to New England?
In all of this happening, as we evolved as an orchestra in the square dance, and Bob and I, Turnbull of us were calling, there was a man from Long Island named Ed Durlacher, who came. We used to come up to the farm, and he'd always want material, and we'd feed him stuff, and he'd go to some of our dances, he'd write down stuff, and he eventually wrote a book called Honor Your Partner, and he had big records with the Union Orchestra and eight or ten piece band, and did actually we didn't think much of it in those days, I guess, but when you look back, he probably did a great deal for square dancing as far as school children and people learning, and a lot of people learning to direct some of these dances. And he was the one that suggested that, you know, there's a guy out in Colorado that really has a different theory about all this, and he's calling together some of the leaders, and you should go out there. Well, and that's kind of how I think that I had heard about it.
Okay, well, even before that, the way I remember first introduction to Western style square dancing was Herb Gregerson.
Well, that's
true. From Brockton, Massachusetts.
Yep. Well, now you jog on my memory again, Bob, and that's true. Herb was one of the early traveling callers around the country, and he did come. He was from El Paso, Texas, and he came through, and we began to recognize two or three things. First of all, that there was something else to square dancing besides what we were doing, and secondly, that there was a conflict in terms, because when he called do-si-do, he didn't want you to go back-to-back. And when we called do-si-do, that's what we wanted. And this became a conflict.
Right.
And I think we heard of Lloyd Shaw out there in Colorado Springs through either him. But I think Durlacher was instrumental in talking to me about it. He didn't go himself, as I recall, but he did go.
And I don't know if Pappy would have let him in.
I don't think he probably would have, no. But out there at Lloyd Shaw's, it was really an education. It was you saw people from all over the country, California and Montana and Wyoming and Texas and all through the Midwest, various leaders and callers, and many of them had things to show. And we didn't have a lot to show, but we did a lot of listening and looking, and became intrigued with some of the things that were happening. As I recall, 1 year, Jonesy Jones, I think it was, from California, who did a lot of square dance calling for some of the early movies, the old black and white movies. And it was about the time that the boom camera came into being. Remember the remember the June Taylor dancers?
Yeah.
And the camera was overhead, and they'd flash down on them, and they'd make all kinds of formation with their arms and legs. Well, they wanted a square dance that would look like a kaleidoscope type of thing, or something that's spectacular for the boom camera.
Right.
Other than that, they were just looking at faces and legs and feet, and but they wanted to get a picture of it from up above. And I think Jonesy Jones was the on staff at one of the studios, and he choreographed the Alaman Bar, the one that we just did this afternoon.
Right.
And it was the first time anybody had ever seen it outside of people who worked in the studio.
Okay.
And he presented it at Lloyd Shaw's. And Lloyd was very amazed, of course, and we were amazed, because it's the first thing, I believe, that first new figure, the first new formation that had come into square dancing for the past 200 years.
Right.
We were doing stuff that came over with the Pilgrims.
Right.
And we were just thrilled with that thing. And Jonesy had worked out all the breaks, Alaman left, Alaman thar, right and left, form a star, let the star of the heavens whirl, right and left, the second girl. He had all this, shoot the star, slip the clutch, and throw in the clutch, and he had all the variations.
Yeah.
And it was like a whole week's project in those days to learn that stuff.
That's right.
And when you learn it, you think, wow, this is great.
Yeah.
And I remember coming back to Connecticut and saying to some of the dancers that, well, you know, you got to take some lessons. We got to show you some of this stuff. And they looked at you like, why do we need lessons? We've been dancing for 20 years, and we've had no any trouble. Why? What's to teach?
Yeah.
So I got up a demonstration team so that to show them, well, this is what. And they taught four couples.
Okay.
And when we demonstrated that in front of the crowd, why, it was amazing how many people were amazed at what you could do. And then they said, well, yeah, well, we would like to learn that. So we formed a class, and that's kind of how the first class got going. And all stemmed back to Lloyd Shaw, in a sense. And, and I recall also, a year later, I think it was Herb Gregerson that was at that, along with many other the early leaders, some of whom are still around, and many who aren't, but was there, and a big argument ensued between Lloyd Shaw and Herb Gregerson about the do-si-do. And Lloyd Shaw, being a research man and had researched various dance movements around the whole country, had discovered, I think, that there was five or six kinds of a do-si-do being done. And in one place in New England, they'd go back-to-back, and out in the Appalachian Mountains, they'd make a big loop and swing the lady around, and up in Colorado, why, they'd flip the corner over and turn partner left and corner right or something like that. And in Texas, they'd make a circle and turn partner left and corner right and partner left. And that was what Herb Gregerson called a do-si-do. So anyway, they almost came to fisticuffs at that point, because they were very headstrong people, both of them. But Lloyd Shaw, being the wiser, I think, and in his wisdom, told Herb that, well, he felt that the true do-si-do, from his reason, was the back-to-back. A la do comes from the French, do meaning back. And consequently, he was leaning that way. But in lieu of the fact that Herb was really very strong on it, that in honor of El Paso, where Gregerson lived, that the dance that Gregerson was doing was not a problem. From now on, it should be called Do Paso, in honor of El Paso, Texas.
Right.
And Herb bought that theory, and from then on, it was Do Paso.
Right.
That's how Do Paso came to being, and how things began to change a little bit and become standardized.
Right. I remember going with you and your wife, and my wife and I, along with Dick Forsher and his wife, into New York City every Saturday morning to Carl Fisher's Publishing House.
That's right.
And we had a series of square dance lessons at that point. And you were there and doing the teaching along with Frank Kaufman, if I remember right. And this was just at the outset of Sets and Order magazine. And you got your material out of Sets and Order at that point. And every month was a new figure.
That's right.
And all of a sudden, this was... And these were all people who were in the teaching profession.
Like, yes.
And they were... It was an interesting... that's where I first learned Pancake Polka.
Oh, is that so?
Which I still do to this day. Frank Kaufman taught that. And any thoughts about that? Do you remember?
Well, I don't have specific thoughts about that, Bob. It was just one more stepping stone, I think, in our progression toward more education and getting more knowledge. Frank Kaufman eventually went on to form a record company and do many things like that with Jesse Polka and Patty Cake Polka and a lot of other folk dancing, folk dances, and both Bob and I had recorded on his label, which was Folkcraft, and put out, I don't know how many sides now, but they were very important dances in the old days. But the Carl Fisher people were very cooperative, as I recall, and they wanted things like that, particularly because the talk was that this should be taught to our young people, used in schools, and a lot of these things were going to be sold to libraries around the country, so they'd have a reference source when anybody out in the Midwest wanted to look up something, and they'd be able to find it, things like that.
Right. We're getting down to the end of this side of this tape.
Okay.
I'm going to run the tape to the end and then turn it over, so just hang in. Before we get too far away, I want to go back to Ed Durlacher and the dances that he used to do around New York City. Can you tell us?
Ed was a good salesman, and he had a very strong personality. And I don't know quite how it happened, but he got into the recreation department of the city of New York and the sanitation department recreation. And he did several things, and one of which was to, he and his band conducted big square dances outside Central Park, in the Central Park Mall, I guess they would call it.
Four sites.
Well, he did things out in the beach area too, didn't he?
Jones Beach. And Riverside Drive.
That's the one I remember.
Right. And while there, and I can't remember where it was.
Then I also know that in the summertime he did another out in New York State in Sunita.
Sunita Hills.
Right. And eventually we went out there and did program out there when he. Evidently, I don't know if he gave it up or what happened to him, but we did that Sunita for a while.
Maybe we were cheaper.
Ed was not cheap, but anyway, they offered square dancing. The one I recall on the outside dances in the summer were at Riverside Drive and Central Park Mall, places like that, and they would attract thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah.
And Ed was good at getting 1,000 people, let's say, off the street, getting them into squares and being able to make them dance.
Right.
The dances were not hard, didn't have to teach much, but when he said circle left, you knew what to do. And
right.
when he said swing your partner, you somehow knew what to do. And,
right.
and he was had a very booming, authoritative voice and very commanding. And he had I guess at that time, the only union square dance band around the area called
right.
the Top Hands.
Right.
And the Top Hands were... I don't think there were seven pieces, or maybe a seven-piece band.
Yeah.
And that was required by the union.
Right.
You couldn't have a smaller band than that. And none of us had a seven-piece band. We had three, four, five-piece band,
right.
and that was the end of it.
Non-union,
yeah.
Right. Of course, you may remember that series was paid for by Pepsi-Cola.
That's right.
And because that gave them the chance to sell and advertise Pepsi-Cola.
Right.
So if they got rained out, they got paid anyway. And they
yeah.
worked four nights a week all summer long.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a tremendous contract.
Sure. And then that's when Ed Durlacher took what we now call the hokey pokey. You put your right foot in, put your right foot out, shake
yeah.
it all about. And then when they used to have them truck on down like a conga line. First you do the Pepsi-Cola, then you do the Coca-Cola. Pepsi-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, what's it all about?
Yeah.
Turn yourself about. And he was advertising Pepsi-Cola right along the line. Then he changed that dance just slightly.
Yeah.
But and we used to play on that too and did that a lot of times.
I've forgotten that.
Oh, sure.
So anyway, along the line there, sometime you decided to build yourself a square dance.
That's right. Somewhere along the line, we got popular enough actually, we had two bands, and I formed a band that was a little more maneuverable travel-wise with an accordion player. And Bob stayed with the original band, I guess, there, Bob, with Mother on the piano and
yeah.
whatnot, until you moved out up to Massachusetts. But in 1948, I started in 1947, I think, went up to Massachusetts to a lumber mill and bought a bunch of lumber, it's green, and trucked it down. And a college roommate of mine named Sherwood Edwards, his mother had a piece of property on Route 25 in Stepney, Connecticut, a commercial road.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought that property for, I think it was $3,000. And, yeah, too bad you don't have it today.
Right.
But it was... a good big piece of property, and we stored the lumber there all winter, cured it, dried it, and then I got a carpenter who used to work for our dad on the farm, built a lot of chicken coops, and he built that great big three-story chicken coop that we
right.
had up back there, and he was the head carpenter. So I got Arnold Payne to come down and a helper to build it. We didn't have any plans. We just had a sketch. Said, well, we want it this long and this wide, and we staked it out and
yeah.
poured the foundations. And
but didn't you buy
I bought what they called a rib arch. It was something new, and it was like a Quonset hut arch, a big rainbow type of arch, and to support the roof. So it was a Quonset type arch and a Quonset type hall, but then it had wings out where it came down. It had wings on the side so that people could sit off the floor.
Right.
And I had a floor, the actual dance floor space was 40 by 80.
Right.
And then I had ladies' room and men's room and coat room and a soda room up in the front and an entranceway. And in the back was a stage. And in back of the stage, I built a small apartment. Because at that point, I think I had a house up in Lake Candlewood, and I sold the house so I could get money enough to build the barn.
Right.
And I built the barn and ran square dances and actually did very, very well for quite a few years there. And when I sold the barn, I figured up at that point my Saturday night average, which was Saturday night was the big night. Now, what I'm saying, if people think about club dancing now, and they well, what club? And
yeah.
This and that, there was no such thing. We didn't. Well, we sort of did have some clubs, but there weren't that many, and we didn't have a club. We just opened the barn. It was open to the public,
yeah.
And we danced easy dances. You walk in, you could dance.
Yeah.
And we averaged, I think, 329 people every Saturday night for 8 years, winter and summer. And there was no air conditioning. I had big fans up in the gable ends of the barn, two big 4-foot fans, I guess they were, or more, and cold in the places in the wintertime.
Well, you advertised that as summer air cooled.
Air cooled, summer air cooled. It was air cooled, all right.
Yeah.
But, you know, we kept them hopping, we kept the dance going, and people warmed up, and after a while it got pretty warm in that barn,
sure.
Even in the dead of winter.
Yeah, well, the height of the ceiling, of course, took away some of the heat.
It did.
And then the big fans blew it out, but it was still hot.
Yeah, it was hot.
But that was always with live music, and
yeah.
The same three guys, the Pioneers.
Same three, you know, fellows, called the Pioneers, and it was Jimmy Gilpin was our star. He was a fiddle player and leader of the band, I guess you might say, was Louis Rosato on the accordion, and Eddie Munson playing guitar.
Right.
They're basically the three.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, we get George Pratt in playing banjo, and he played five string as well as regular banjo.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, people would call up and could they sit in and play with us?
Yeah.
And we had a lot of people wanting to sit in for practice.
Right.
And we'd get an extra instrument or two. And sometimes they were pretty good and sometimes they weren't. But basically, it was a three-piece band. And I understand now, Bob, you were telling me that band is still playing together, the same three guys. How many years? 59 years, and they're still playing together. And I think that's probably one of the oldest band in the country now that is stuck together, all is still playing.
Has to be.
And they're busy three or four nights a week right now.
Yeah, and they're working with Culver Griffin there.
Yeah, Culver Griffin.
And, in fact, I had lunch with the accordion player just last week, as a matter of fact.
Did you?
We should do an article on them. I tell you, they're really amazing that they would be together that long.
Yeah.
And before they hooked up with you, they were playing steadily at a place called Medlicott's.
Medlicott's barn in New Milford, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And that was a square dance barn. It was a barn in an actual barn, a dairy barn.
Dairy barn, right.
And it was the hayloft or the portion of the barn. And it was a very popular spot.
Yeah,
around the country in those days, we played in a lot of barns. There were quite a few barns that were actually barns.
Mm.
And there were cows downstairs, and you danced upstairs and things like that.
Yeah, and many of them turned into full-time operations.
Absolutely.
Like Bay Path Barn.
Yeah. And they're still going today. Bay Path Barn's still going.
Right.
I don't know how many others. Square Acres was probably the biggest facility up there, and Howard Hogue formed that, built a big place out there, and started with a barn, but it turned into a big place.
He kept adding on,
and he'd added another dance hall. How's that?
Finally wound up, I think, with about five.
He had five dance halls going on Saturday night. You could go in. He could take a beginner class, a basic group, or an intermediate group, or an advanced group, or a roundings group. He had five halls going on one night.
And
a lot of people.
They dance for a few weeks in one hall and graduate.
Then they graduate to the next hall.
Object was to finally get into the big hall.
Yeah, get to the big hall.
Where they had all traveling callers
and
so forth. And Just in passing, we should mention that that was just after Lawrence Loy passed away. Oh. It was called Loy Hall.
Loy Hall, yes.
Right.
Well, Lawrence Loy, as Bob can tell you, was very instrumental in promoting square dancing and making it grow and prosper up in the state of Massachusetts. And at the
well, he was the one that brought Herb Gregerson.
Was he the one that brought Herb Gregerson
in the first place? So.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. So, well, anything further about the barn before we get too far away?
Well, not too much. Actually, when I went out to Lloyd Shaw's, I had the barn. I came back and said, you know, we got to have some lessons. And people were saying, hey, we've been coming to this barn for quite a while. We've danced in 20 years, and we can dance with the best of them. And they didn't think they needed any lessons. And that's where that first demonstration team, we had people that were regulars. Yeah. They would come every week, and they were pretty good dancers. And we had this demonstration team, and I taught them the elements are and all the element dar breaks type of thing, and we used it as a demonstration, and that's how I got my first class.
Yeah.
And from that was formed the Connecticut Square Dance Club,
right.
And we used the barn on I think it was a Friday night. I guess finally it was the club night,
right.
And Saturday night was open dance night,
right.
So we began to use other nights of the week, and it started. The first Western style class that I started was there at the barn,
right.
And it grew from there.
I remember Fran and Clyde Morris.
Well, yeah.
Beautiful.
He worked in a hatchery up in New Milford, and
beautiful.
They were beautiful dancers, and they were very smooth, and they could swing 16 counts and then bang on the button.
Right. They'd love a weekend like this, wouldn't
they? Oh, they would. They would.
Right. So, well, then you started branching out, and you started weekend events and so forth. Also, I know you were...
Well, that's true. After a while, I can't remember where the very first weekend was.
Yeah.
But I guess I do remember. It was in Danbury at the Hotel Green, which is no longer there. And
the building's there. It's
the building's there, but it's the Hotel Green.
Elderly housing.
Yeah, right. Something like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, they had a ballroom there, or dancing area.
Yeah.
And I ran a weekend there, and to get people together. And the basic idea was that a lot of people wanted to learn this Western style, and there were a lot of callers in the area that couldn't do it. They didn't know what it was either.
Yeah.
They'd seen it, but they couldn't call it. They didn't know how to use it. And so the object of the weekend is, well, let's get together, and if you get together over the weekend, we could teach the whole thing in a weekend.
Right.
And but you could in those days.
Right.
So we started this weekend at the Hotel Green in Danbury,
yeah.
And it turned into a successful event, and a lot of leaders came. People, even like physical ed teachers from New York school system, things like that, came to learn new stuff and dance, and. We began to branch out then from Danbury Hotel Green up into other hotels and other facilities. And I don't know just where we went from Danbury. I think we went to Pittsfield, Massachusetts to the...
what was the name of the hotel?
Yeah, I can't think of the name of the hotel.
I can't either. But
it'll come to me probably.
Right.
But we worked up there, and then... eventually, we ended up in Jug End Barn, which was a big country resort, and they had a nice hall up in the hills there. And we ran, probably 5 or 6 weekends a year up there.
Right.
And I started to import callers from various areas. Other people started to, travel and get known. And
were these people you met at Shaw's?
No, not all of them. Some of them were. I brought Ed Gilmore. I met him at Shaw's, I believe. And I thought a lot of Ed. And I had Ed Gilmore come in. And then Ed Gilmore started some weekends and things out in Steamboat Springs, Colorado.
Right.
And out there, and I was on his staff. So we kind of swapped business things, and I was on his staff, he was on mine.
That was when you started meeting other national callers.
That's when I started to meet a lot of other national callers, national leaders. And
Manning and
Nita Smith. And big on round dancing. Nita was the first one to start the petticoat idea and the petty pant idea. She made her first petty pants out of two pillowcases and sewed up a petticoat, then eventually ended up in the petticoat business as one of the most prominent petticoats in the country for a long time, but has since had to go out of business or sold the business.
But you were at Jug End Barn for several years.
Several years at Jug End Barn, and we brought in callers, that, a lot of them whom you've interviewed, I suppose. Curly Custer comes to mind, and Earl Johnston, and Bob Yarrington, and Ronnie Snyder, and Johnny LeClaire, and I guess a whole raft of them. And people were then anxious to go to these weekends to hear these fellas, because they came in from, you know, Wyoming, from LeClaire, and Maryland, from Curly, and different people, and they were following. They had a following. And we did pretty good with the weekend business for quite many, many years.
So how did you get associated with West Point?
Well, I was running a summer thing. I think it started at the barn. Way back there. And Frank Kaufman and Ricky Holden came to me and said that they were looking for a facility because they had some sort of made an arrangement with the City of New York school system to give interim credits to school teachers who would take this course in square dancing and be able to go back the following fall and teach square dancing in the New York schools around Long Island and New York City. And so instead of renting them the barn, I became a partner in the enterprise and started to run a school, actually, for these teachers. And we gave out certificates and everything else if they came. The school was a week long, and we taught how to teach a basic square dance, the basic stuff that we all knew, and then some of the newer stuff. But they were going to go back and teach kids. And we'd invite in dancers from the area at night so that these teachers could practice, and it was a kind of a fun thing. Mm-hmm. And we called it an institute. And I think it was Ginger Brown, who had come way down from Medway, Massachusetts, with her husband Lou, to dance, and got interested in some of this stuff. And she said, well, it's not really an institute. This is more fun than it is education. You really should call it Funstitute. So we thought, that's a great idea. We coined this word. So we coined Funstitute. It was Ginger's idea. And from then on, we ran a Funstitute. It was an institute based on having fun. And there was a guy who graduated from Springfield College of Recreation, a man, and named Bill Lewis.
Bill Lewis.
And William F. Lewis. And he had been in the Army, and was posted at West Point, and he loved it so much that he didn't want to leave West Point, and he was due for a tour. They were going to shift him out. So he resigned from the Army because he had an opportunity to become physical education, I'm not sure it was director, but nevertheless, a good position on West Point, and he gained a permanent position to teach high rings and barn
gymnastics
at the West Point for the cadets.
Yeah.
And he came to the Funstitutes and he was intrigued. And finally, I sold the barn and I didn't have anywhere to go. He said, you know, the Hotel Thayer up at West Point, it's got a beautiful old ballroom, nice wooden floor and everything else. He said, why don't you come up there? And instead of farming people out here and there like we did and having to worry about catering food for them and all, he said, the hotel can do all that.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, if you want, I'll set it up for you. I said, well, I'll go up and take a look. So I went up to West Point, which was not actually too far. It's only an hour and a half, 2 hours away.
Right.
And talked to the whole people and the hotel people, and they were thrilled because they weren't that busy. And this is in those days, was a non-profit hotel. It's a government-owned hotel,
right,
being managed by some colonel up there. And he didn't. And so we got the use of West Point Fair Hotel.
Yeah.
And actually, even before that, Bill, through Bill, I had gone up there myself to teach square dancing at the officers' club, and I because he was starting to get into it, but since he was on staff at West Point and he was not an officer, he got me up there because I was at that point the expert there, yeah. And he was there front and center, and he was able to get into the officers' club, and we had the officers and wives. I think it was twice a month they'd meet. We'd run a dance, and I'd teach them how to do it. And some of those fellows since have been overseas and did a little calling, and really we had almost a square dance club there. And I can't remember why I stopped, but anyway, I did. And Bill then took it over, and he kept running up there, and I guess, of course, he's retired now, living out in Arizona somewhere, but he was very instrumental in that. And for years, why, we ran the Hotel Thayer, and this was a summer institute called Funstitute.
Do you remember one when you called, first call he did, called Texas Star? Being a military man, he got up and he said, lead to the center and back to the bar, hop, two, three, four.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
He cracked up the whole floor.
Yeah, he did. Well, I do remember also that I always did a contra or two up there,
uh-huh.
And at that session. And one of the favorites was the fireman's dance.
Right.
And it's part of the routine. This is, I guess, what they call a mascalanza or something now. Where the,
mascalanza.
Yeah. Four people in line, they're passing through another four, and they go on to the next and out around. But it had double lines or something. But the basic thing at a certain point in the dance, everybody yells, fire, fire, water, water. And then the caller says, forward and back and cross right over.
Yeah.
And which is all part of the routine. And people, you get a couple hundred people in the hall all yelling, fire, fire, at the same time. They could hear it down at the guardhouse at the bottom of the hill where the hotel was. Got excited. They sent somebody up to check it out.
Did they really?
Yeah,
every day.
One time. Then also Bill Lewis, being a little jokester, and he got up in the balcony. Okay, and we danced right under this balcony. And after we did this year or two, and I was up there calling fire, fire, water, water, and he made a big deal. He had a big bucket of water, and he let it know. He took a dipper and he poured the water, and everybody on the floor could see it but me. He was sort of behind me. And he was up there, and he's giving him the signal, and he's going to dump this water on me. When we yelled, fire, fire, water, water, I was going to get the water. And so I'm, you know, I don't even know this. And actually, he had another bucket there full of confetti, chopped up paper, you know.
Right.
And I'm going on fire, fire, water, water, and everybody's looking up and they're grinning. I'm going to get smoked, and he throws a paper down on me. But he did things like that. It was a fun thing.
He was a funny guy.
He still is, I'm sure.
Yeah. Where'd you say he lives,
Frank? Somewhere out in Arizona. I think it's Sun City, Bob. I'm not sure.
Couple of Sun Cities.
Yeah, I think it's in the Scottsdale, Arizona, Phoenix area.
All right, well, that maybe this is a good time to. Still, I know you've got to get back to your room.
Yeah, I do.
We're going to have to get ready for dinner. So
yeah,
we're just about to the end of this side of the tape. So
all
why
right.
Don't we end it right here, and we'll start again on another. On another session sometime.
Wow, let's do that. It's been a long time getting this one.
I know. Of all the times we've been together.
Yes.
And especially since your wife passed away. And we've been to a couple of conventions together. We've been to Colorado together.
Yeah.
Travel up the West Coast together and so forth. Never took the time to do this. So.
Well, it's good to do it. And we'll get back to another session and start another tape.
I don't know if I should mention it, but you're the next to the last Hall of Famer for me to be.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The only one left that I haven't already interviewed that is still with us is Cal Golden.
Yeah.
I hope to get him in Hot Springs, Arkansas on the way back to Albuquerque. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, by the time I finish this trip, I will have talked to all the surviving Hall of Fame Milestone, Color Lab Milestone Award, and Rondo Lab Silver Halo Award recipient.
Right. So, well, I know, Bob, there's a lot of people that think you're doing a great job, and we know it's a volunteer job for you, and it's time-consuming and expensive, and we know that you would like to get some funds coming in, well, if at all possible, to help pay some of the costs on this, transportation and getting around, and big costs coming up still to transcribe these tapes and put it in form, and I think the cause is really good. It's going to eventually become part of the archives of the Lloyd Shaw Foundation, and so that anybody who wants to learn about the history from the word of mouth from the people that made it can get it there at Lloyd Shaw there in Phoenix. Albuquerque.
Right, okay, well, let's end it right here, and we'll get back on another tape at another time.
Okay, look forward to it.
Stopped unexpectedly again, and Al was just talking about color suit.
Yes, and Earl Johnston and I, we looked around for a facility, and as I recall, our first facility was the Wendell Sherwood Hotel up in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And we had our group in there, and they served the meals, and they had the rooms, and so we operated there for some years. And then we moved to East Hill Farm up in near Keene, New Hampshire. And then we did another school out in Oquaga, out in western New York State. And because something, I don't know, maybe that was before we went to East Hill. We were looking around for places because the hotel got very expensive and we couldn't get the days we wanted. A lot of things happened in that, so we looked around. We finally went to Oquaga, and then we went to East Hill for a lot of years, and we ended up in Sturbridge Village, or not in Sturbridge Village, but in Sturbridge, Massachusetts, at the Hayloft, which is a square dance barn up there that the dancers had taken over. It was an old building, and they'd taken it over, made a nice dance hall out of it, nice floor. And Earl Johnston had called there many, many times and over the years, and so we ran the school there. And Earl Johnston and I ran it for, I guess, 29 to 30 years, something like that. And then since we both retired, we turned the school over to Ken Ritucci and Randy Page, to what we'd call young callers. They're not that young today, but they always came to the school. They supported it, and they were quite knowledgeable and very interested in teaching other callers. So they now run the school.
Well, you had extra help, too, of other leaders around the country that helped at your school.
Oh, yes. We always had... tried to bring someone in. We had Jim Mayo with us for many years, and he was a voice specialist. Jim had done some study with voice and was very good at that, as well as knew his dance material, choreography and breathing and enunciation and things of that nature, which callers, of course, need. And so we had Jim Mayo as part of the staff. And we brought in people that were like Deuce Williams to teach more advanced dancing, because Deuce was in that area. And then we ran school. We had Lee Kaufman 1 year. In fact, Lee attended our school 1 year, even before we had him on staff. And we tried to discourage him from writing too much material, but it didn't do a bit of good. You can see we never got through to him. But he's written so many things he can't remember. Yeah. But we've had those kind of people. Jack Lazary was important in our schools for some time. And we had Vaughn Parrish. I'm sure these names escape me. And Vaughn Parrish was out. And I think we had Ron Snyder. And we've had... I haven't given this a lot of thought, but a lot of leaders from around the country, and they each had a lot to offer.
Right.
And so they helped us with the school, and we were successful. And I think now the school is still running, and I think it's there again. It's probably like the Pioneers Orchestra. is the oldest running orchestra still in existence with the same original people. I think our choir school is the oldest still successful existing school in the United States. I think we've run more schools and more years than anybody else.
So when did News and Notes get started?
News and Notes here again. We felt the need to, a lot of the people from our schools said, wow, this is great. We'd like to, you know, keep in touch, and as things come along, how do we get this information? And we decided, well, we can't call up everybody or write them personal letters, so we'll start this note service, and we can send out information to callers, and which is what we did. And it was called News and Notes, and we had 8 pages, I think, 4 sides, 8.5 by 11, 2 sides, and 4 pages, 2 sides. And we had news of what's happening in the area, and then we had notes of how you do it, you know, how do you get into this and how do you get out. And then we had new figures. About that time, choreography was developing, and if you look at Burleson's encyclopedia, you'll find there's over 4,000 square dance calls in there, and they're all a little bit different. And they were coming out at the rate of 10 or 12 a month in those years. And we'd list all those, and Earl would analyze them. And said he wasn't as caustic as Frank Coleman was in some of his comments,
right.
But he would say, you know, this is ill-timed, it doesn't flow, it makes you use your right hand 3 times in a row, or, you know, he had some reason why it was not good. But then he'd list 3 or 4 more, and he said, if you want a good one to workshop this month, then take this one.
Yeah.
And he'd recommend one, and he also would recommend a record. The record companies were producing oodles of records every month.
Right.
So, and this is before Hanhurst tape service and all that, and he would listen to the records and analyze them and tell them why he thought that they were good or not good.
Right.
So the News and Notes came along because of a need. Callers were asking about material and how do they tell a good piece of material from a bad piece of material.
Right.
And of course, this is long before Caller Lab and people like that now set themselves up to tell you, well, this is what we recommend, sort of thing.
Right.
It's a guideline, at least. But that's how it started, and we developed not only the people that went to our schools, but a lot of other callers around the country subscribed to the notes because they needed the same kind of stuff.
And was one of the early note services, too.
It was. I think,
well,
Will Orlick
probably
was the earliest.
Or maybe in Northern California.
Well, there was Southern California. Southern California Callers Association did put out a good set of notes,
right.
And that was very popular. That's right, Bob. And they were perhaps the first, I don't know.
Yeah,
right. But we were not the first by a long shot.
Yeah.
But we...
Well, I know that you were heavily involved with Caller Lab and one of the founding members and so forth. Tell us a little about how Caller Lab got started and about what time we're talking about.
Well, Caller Lab... actually, Caller Lab got started because of Bob Osgood.
Sure.
And Bob Osgood, of course, was the editor of the Sets in Order magazine, and as such, a long while back, he had set up a merit program. Well, he had set up the Hall of Fame, actually.
Yeah,
American Square Dance Society, that's right. Correct, Bob. And that wasn't Bob personally, it was a group. Anyway, and he felt that... the activity probably wasn't really headed in the direction that we all had felt that it should go, that Lloyd Shaw, who was the daddy of all these ideas, more or less, and set the philosophy for a good dance activity, he wouldn't have been happy with it, and maybe we should get together and talk about it and get... There's a lot of renegade callers out there that maybe... if we all got together, we could help the activity. And I think Bob was and is still a deep thinker and very dedicated to the activity. So he, in effect, got the Hall of Fame members called them together to talk about it.
That was a
Sylmar. Now, I did not go to the first meeting. For some reason, I was unable to make it, and as were some of the others. But I don't know, there was six or eight callers at that first session. And so they formed, and Bob was real good at coining words, and he coined the word caller lab. It was a laboratory, so to speak, situation for callers. And the next year I did attend. The meeting was, I don't even remember where it was, but it might
I think they skipped a couple of years.
They might have skipped a year to get himself organized, but actually we did meet, and more of a formal proclamation was formed, and a code of ethics and some bylaws to go, operate by, and a statement of purposes, what our purpose was and our goal was. And so I was in on the forming of all that, and at that point there was still only 14 or 15 callers involved. But every caller that was involved was a very well-known leader in his own area and doing a lot for square dancing all along, and dedicated people. And the following year we set up a program where every caller could invite one more, and then the next year every caller could invite one more, so it kind of doubled every year for a while. And now that's not the rule, but that's the way it got started, and we felt it was a worthwhile organization. In line with Caller Lab, Bob, I might also mention that along about that time, I'd mentioned that there was an awful lot of new material coming in. We featured it in our note service, so did Jack Lazary, so did Bill Peters, and so did the Southern California, and so did Will Orlick, and everybody had these things going. And at that point, the traveling caller came into being, or even before that. And he traveled around, and for instance, Marshall Flippo would come into New England, and he'd do six or eight dates around New England, and he'd go up to New York State and over to Ohio, and he'd come back next year. But every time he came, he'd bring something new to workshop. One week later, another traveling caller would come in. He'd workshop something else. One week later, somebody else would come in, and he works up the third thing. So after about two or three months of this, you had so much material that was workshop, and that people had, the dancers had taken a look at and actually danced, that it became to be a hodgepodge. And people were, the dancer was getting a little angry, because if you did all these things, then people that weren't at that particular dance didn't get it, so you have to review it and workshop it. And the dancers were becoming big workshops to try to catch up with all this stuff. And they said, we didn't come for this, we want to just dance. Why doesn't somebody do something about it? So they at SARDA, I believe it was, the Eastern District of Square Dance Association of Square Dance Clubs got into it. This is representing dancers. And they asked Charlie Baldwin if he would come to Caller Lab. This is when Caller Lab was quite new, and present this problem. Because here we are with the professional callers all over the country, and we helped create the problem. Now we'll make us solve it. And so he did come out to Caller Lab, and with this problem. So Caller Lab decided that the way you solved the problem was to create a list and to create levels and create this. Now, this was not a brand new idea with Caller Lab. California people had their own list of basics. Bob Osgood had it when he started Sets in Order, the list of 48 basics, which we still are pretty much the same basics, only a few changes.
Right.
And so they, and John Henron, I believe, had a list of his own up in New England.
Yeah.
And there were callers around the country, but there again, every list was different. Every caller made up his own list of things that he wanted to use and that he called beginner or intermediate or advanced.
Right.
So Caller Lab took this project over, and we decided that if we'd all agree that this was going to be the sort of official organization to present the list and have it screened by the Caller Lab organization, representing a lot of real good callers that the people would accept it, which they did. And now there's speculation, was it good or was it bad? And did we do the right thing or the wrong thing? But I believe that if we had not have done it, we would have been worse.
Sure.
And I think so. On that basis, I guess it was a good thing.
Right. So, let's talk a little about a little more serious subject. I've been asking most everybody, what's your overview of where do you think square dancing has been and where is it going?
Well, that's a good question, Bob, and I think the first part of that is where it's been and where it's going. But where it's been, when you and I got into square dancing, it was just a Saturday night or a Friday night at the firehouse and Saturday night here and there. It was being done in bar rooms and downstairs basement places that were not what you might say culturally acceptable to society, many of them. And I feel that even my own dance hall, when we opened up, we were in proximity of Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we had people come out from there. And if a ship pulled in full of sailors and they had the night off, a lot of them would come out to the barn, and that's the only time we'd see them. They'd ship out 2 days later. And it was okay, because in those days, you didn't have to learn a thing to go square dancing. You just walk in, and not everything, but most things were very self-explanatory. And the caller would say, circle left, and you kind of somehow you know what to do. He said, swing your partner, and you could figure that out. And when you got on the floor, if you formed up a couple three or couple four, by the time the dance got around to you, you'd know it from observation if you kept your eyes open. So everybody could dance and have a good time, and that's basically what it was all about. But with the advent of the new material, and with the teaching program that was set up, and with people actually learning how to do an Alaman left and a grand, how many counts it takes, and who do you meet, and how do you twirl, and where do you go when you promenade, all that kind of thing, for brand new people, things began to improve. The square dancing was taken out of the rougher element, let's say. It was put on a more of a family basis. Men and wives and children participated. It wasn't just a sailor walking in to get a dance with what girl he could find. And I feel it had been upgraded. And Lloyd Shaw was a big part of this. This is what he foresaw and wanted to happen. And I think it did happen. And so we've elevated square dancing to the point where now you're able to get a school to run it in, or you're able to get a church hall, or you're able to get... it's more of a respected activity. And, of course, I guess many people feel it's the folk dance, of American folk dance. And as such, why we should preserve it and give it... some prestige and culture. And I think that it basically has happened. Now, as to where it's going, it may be going back. I don't know. The level system has gotten, in many areas, has divided the square dancer up, so he's no longer happy to go to a square dance club, socialize with some friends, have a cup of coffee and talk and socialize, and laugh and have a good time. He has to have more material, which is a mathematical solution to a social activity. And I'm not sure that that's really the thing that's going to keep square dancing alive and make it the folk dance of America. I think it's going to be great. But many areas already have wound up in the real high levels becoming nothing more than cellar parties or study groups, because in order to keep up, if you don't study this stuff two or three or four nights a week, you can't keep up when you go to a challenge convention or you go to a challenge dance. There's too much material for most people to retain. As I mentioned earlier, over 4,000 maybe five by now, in Burleson's encyclopedia, and how many of these things can you memorize? Well, 200 or 300 is a good score, but some people know 300, and they feel that they're superior to the person who only knows 100. It doesn't make them a better person. In fact, it makes them a worser person, if there is such a word as worser. But it makes them feel that, well, you know, you better do this right because I'm in your square. I know that stuff cold, and I can't help you. There's not many laughs. There are groups, I must say, and that do laugh and have a good time, and if you make a mistake, it's not such a big deal. But gradually, some of those things, I feel, are going to possibly be the ruination. It's drifting back into private groups. And if you can't dance, keep out of my square. Already has happened. And that's not the spirit that we were taught and that we grew up with. So I think the spirit of square dancing is being torn down slowly. There are several clubs in Florida that I dance to in once in a while, now that I'm dancing and not calling anymore, that I feel still have the spirit. Frank Bedell in Boynton Beach, Florida, has a cast-offs club. It's a beautiful club. And they have club uniform. They do club projects. They go places together. They have a long refreshment break every time. People talk with each other. They love Frank. I mean, they support him all the time. They have a beginner class, and they start in group new people every year. And there's committees. They sing. They announce birthdays. If you've got an anniversary, they give you a cake. I mean, they do a lot of sociable, nice things. And the level is plus. It's not challenge, although there are some challenge dancers that dance there. They dance good rounds in between, and that's part of the activity as well. The real high-level challenge dancer, many times, and most of them, I would say, probably don't even dance rounds, which is also a very nice part of our activity.
Right.
And they couldn't care less about contras. And here we are this weekend having a great time doing contras, and we find that, hey, they're pretty intricate. I know one challenge dancer down here right now that is having a little trouble doing some, well, supposedly all real simple stuff. He wouldn't be bothered with it. He can't quite make it through, even after instruction.
Right.
But anyway, I feel that it'll probably never die out completely. There'll always be somebody doing the square dance somewhere.
Right.
I feel that it has dropped off, as we all know, over the past few years, to where it is a serious problem in many areas. Also, I'm hearing reports, well, if we could combine the clubs together, we'd have a decent club again. Well, people don't want to do that. We dance on Wednesday. I'm not going to dance on Friday.
Your call or my call?
Yeah, whose call are you going to get? And they're wrangling.
Sure.
And I can understand it's human nature, but our whole human nature in our country is changing, Bob.
Sure.
You know, look at road rage now. Look at all the things that are going on.
Right.
If you don't hurry up and beat a red light, some guy behind you bumps you. It's terrible.
Yeah. But
this is what's happening. This mentality is getting into square dancing.
Sure.
And I feel that it's not going to really help make it our big national social activity, family activity. I think it's going to segregate it into small specialist groups. It's already done that. And I think it probably will get worse before it gets better. And I don't have the solution.
Right. Well, I think you'll agree that there are pockets of areas like north of Boston, for example. I talked with Tony Parks. They're up there dancing 10 or 12, 15 basics, and that's it. And that's all they ever want to learn.
Absolutely. I do agree with that. And a good example right here this weekend, Dick Ledger is here on staff, and Dick Ledger does do some of the plus movements, but basically he's a mainstream caller, and he's been so for the last 40 years or more, to my knowledge, and he runs a very successful program. He's giving a lot of people a very good time. Jerry Helt out in Cincinnati is another one of these people.
Right.
He has not gone into the advanced levels.
Right.
And he's a very, very popular caller because
sure.
He's got some very good material. He's a real nice guy. And the people that dance with him are very, very nice people.
Right.
And this is the kind of thing we really need.
Right.
But we need more people that will actually do that. And, you know, one of our problems is a caller gets prominent. He begins to know more material, and he wants to go into the higher levels with his calling.
Right.
And he doesn't want to be bothered with teaching beginners anymore because he has to run an A2 workshop.
Yeah.
And consequently, he leaves the teaching of new people to some caller that's 6 months old as a caller. I mean, he really doesn't really do a good job, so some of the training is not so good.
Right.
And I know that it's been said that we used to say, well, come on in, we're going to teach you how, if you can walk, you can square dance, don't worry about it. And it's been said, well, that's true. We've said that long enough now that we got a bunch of walkers in there. We don't dance. we have lost the danceability
right. In
many cases.
Yeah. We're getting down near the end of this section of the tape. I have one more serious question.
Okay.
Looking back on your career, do you have any regrets? Anything you wish you'd done differently?
Ah, boy, I don't know, Bob. No, I think probably not. I don't have any serious regrets anyway. I know I made a serious mistake long, long, long ago. I was calling at the Houston, Texas Festival with Doc Jurnell and Ed Gilmore. Oh, I don't know, Gilmore was there, a lot of callers. And they had like maybe 20, 30 callers at those festivals. They had local callers come in and they'd all call one number. And I had like a 5-minute spot I could call one number. And Grady Hestia was there with his orchestra. And it was live music. We didn't have any recordings, I don't think, that early in the game. And I can't remember what I called, but it went over big. It was a singing call. And it was very big. And I got what you might say was a standing applause. Applaud, people yelling more and more. And the committee man, I'm supposed to quit, get off the stage, I didn't know what to do. The committee man rushed up on the stage and he came to me and said, no, he said, that's not our problem. We don't let anybody, we've got 13, 14 callers to go on tonight's program.
Right.
Your 5 minutes is up. You have to get off the stage. And I started to pack, and the people yelled, screamed, no, what more? So he said, well, all right, we'll make one exception, but get going. So I turned to Grady Hestia, and I said, do you know Marching Through Georgia? And the reason I said that is because that went over real big from our crowd, and I got them revved up again.
So, right.
So he said, no, I don't think we know that. How does anybody not know that, you know? And I whistled it, and he said, no, I don't know. He said, well, I said, I'll tell you what, I'll start it. You just give me the rhythm and play some chords, and we'll just do it anyway. You have to do this. So I did Marching Through Georgia. And I think that was the worst thing I could have done. I didn't realize that Marching Through Georgia, and I'm in Texas,
yeah,
below the Mason-Dixon line,
right,
is not a very good choice. And I got no tremendous response. I got no loud applause. I got a very quiet hall, and I walked off a very, very, a very, very hangdog caller.
Right.
And I've never been back. I've never been invited back to Houston since that day. And that was like, I think it was 50 years ago, Bob, maybe more. And I guess that's my only regret. Right. I should have used better judgment.
Right. Well, there's another story about Texas. We got a minute on the tape. Where he went down into Texas, and he always had that long horn steer on his front of his shirt.
Right.
And the horns went out his sleeves. he made the comment at this convention. He said, you know, you Texans down here, you weren't the first ones to have cattle ranches. He said, we had them back in Long Island long before people started raising Texas. And the day after, the next day, the paper came out and said, well, we found out that all of the bulls from Ed Durlacher's not on his shirt. We're just about to the end, Al. And, Collie, I appreciate you taking the time. It took us long enough to get it done. After we leave here, we'll probably get down to dinner and find out we missed talking about another half a dozen things.
Well, maybe we can get together some other time, Bob, and do another one, another tape.
So, for the sake of the tape, we'll call this the conclusion of our interview with Al Brundage, currently living in Florida. And Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. I hope you, and I believe in your project. I think it's the greatest thing that we're being done and badly needed, and you're fulfilling a lot about history and giving us the wherewithal to preserve it.
Okay.
You're doing a great job, Bob.
Good. Thanks very much. Okay.